technical shit that you got to learn if you want to be a broadcaster, or in this case, a podcaster. Same difference. And when it comes to the actual production end of it, I guess. And it's because the mouse went out on me, man. That right side mouse just went fucking belly up on me, this one here. Prod 2, what we call production left or production 2, which is actually... No, that's production 2. This is production 1. Yeah, it doesn't work. Now, yes, I should get up off my ass and crawl down there and, you know, change it out, but I didn't this weekend because there was a lot of shit that happened this weekend in my personal life. Nothing bad, all good, all, you know, all manageable and controllable and shit, but just stuff that took my, fuck my attention. All right, man. So what do you want to do here? Is that Ted Lieu? Oh, David Hanley. I don't know who it is. Is this on the roof of one of those buildings in Hollywood? I think it is. Or maybe not. How to get along. What was the show? Anybody remember that movie? The movie with Michael Douglas and Demi Moore where she supposedly, you know, she... I thought it was kind of a stretch. I don't know. She sexually harasses him. You know, she basically attacks him in her office and forces him to get a hard on against his will. I mean, I shouldn't laugh because I know that it's probably. I shouldn't laugh. Nonetheless, what was it called? Disclosure. It was in the early 90s. It was based. It was a movie. Was about a tech company. You know, a new tech company, like a computer company or some shit, a software company, in Seattle. In a brick fucking, you know, refurbished brick post-yuppie building. And, you know, everything you would think looked just like that commercial they just had on there. And Donald Sutherland played the owner of the company who came in for a very brief, well, no, not very brief. He had a couple of good scenes, maybe three. He was great. Everybody in the movie was really good. I enjoyed the movie. I thought that... When we got around to the whole sex attack thing, I don't know. Because Michael Douglas played this. He's panicked as she's pushing him onto the desk. And I guess sitting on him or whatever the fuck. And, fuck, what's happening to me? I got a fucking dick by my erection. You know, the reason why I'm laughing is, like, generally fear, you can't get a fucking hard on if you're afraid. You can't, you know. One thing about your dick, it's an emotional, you know, it's a lie detector. It's a lie detector. Tells you how you're fucking feeling. If you're with a woman and you can't get a hard on, and unless you have a physical thing that's going on, you know, but I'm just talking about the whole, you know, if you're panicked, you got something going on there, you know. Maybe it's about her. Maybe it's about women. Maybe it's about just some shit that's happening in your life that, you know, that day, that week, that month, that year, that fucking decade. But I don't know. I can't remember. And I shouldn't be talking this way because I know we have mixed comedy. But this is the pre-show. This is what happens during our pre-show. It's unedited. It has to be because when you're, like I've said many times, when you're, you know, free-forming, you cannot edit yourself. But I'll just put it this way. I've never heard of anybody close to me. Can you remember, let me ask you, do you remember any time in your life where you were scared and you had a hard fucking dick? You had an erection. Now, there's only one time you're going to have an erection, when you're sexually aroused. Now, throw in fear. The two don't mix, man. The two don't go to fucking together. You know, they don't go together. They just don't. There's no fucking way abject fear, paranoia, and hard-ons. Some cats, because they're psychopaths, can get a hard-on in the middle of violence and in the middle of God knows, you know, there are crazy fucking moments that we can't even imagine. But from what I understand, psychopaths are sexually aroused by violence and control. So that's not fear, you know. That's a different thing. See, that's my only thing. Otherwise, I don't give a shit. Why, the first time I've got a hard on, you're scared to death. Who cares? It works. Here's a guy here, Anthony Bourdain. I could give a fuck how and I'm sure he's a nice guy, and I mean nothing by. I don't like the show. I don't like the food that he eats. I don't like the slop that he eats. Like I said, I'm sure he's a very fine man. I mean that. He looks like a nice guy. He looks like a guy to sit down and have a beer with in a second. No sweat at all. Sit down and finish off a bottle of wine. I just wouldn't be able to fucking order the same shit he orders. And I know, well, you know, it's adventurous, Phil. He's, what are these guys drinking? And where are they? China? Are they on a commune in, oh, that's a fish commune. You can see somebody just took a dump in the fish tank. I'm kidding. So this is our pre-show, and this is our live stream for Sunday night. And if you're just tuning in now, because I know we said 6 o'clock, you haven't missed a goddamn thing, okay? Everything's good. We haven't started the show yet. We're probably going to do on the show tonight, for those of you who are sort of unfamiliar with the drill and how this happens, you may be a brand spanking new BSP. And first and foremost, let me say thank you and welcome. Welcome, brother. Welcome, brother and sister. When you're the member of the BSP family, it's a dysfunctional family. You know, on Saturday nights, we have a chat. And in fact, we may be chatting right now. Let me see. People might be on chatting right now.
I remember the first time when I was free.
I don't know if anybody's on chatting or not. Sometimes you have to kind of encourage people to chat it up. Look at this. Nathan, people get erections during fights. Bullshit. And here's David Jefferson is weighing in with his fucking political bullshit. I think this is maybe some people's way of... this is in the morning. Some cat just logged on in the morning. So we got Nathan's on there. So if anybody's out there in BSP land and wants to chat, Nathan looks like he's the only cat that's on. Pensacola, how you doing, Nathan? People get erections during fights. What the fuck? Good Lord. All right. So anyway, there's a little chat box down at the bottom of the thing. And you are more than welcome to do the thing. I just finished reading Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. And I know it sounds, but I know that sounds like I think I'm so fucking smart, which I am, but it doesn't help. Believe me. Guns of August is Barbara, the eminent historian Barbara Tuchman's history of the first month of World War I, August, a pivotal month in which the Allies, represented by the French and the British, basically, and the Russians, fucked everything up that they could possibly fuck up. And the Germans did everything right they could possibly do right until the end of the fucking month. In all this month, this amazing month of August 1914, the most imbecilic generals that the British had, the stupidest motherfuckers that the French had, going up against some of the sharpest minds in the German military machine, from the Kaiser all the way on down, you know. And in that month of August, as shit just went completely fucking south for the French, for the people of Belgium. It was unbelievable what Germany did to Belgium. We often think of German cruelty and German inhumanity, and we associate it with the Nazis. I hate to have to report this to you, but the Germans of World War I were brutal fucking fascist motherfuckers. They set fire to villages. They shot civilians just on sight. They destroyed an ancient library that was filled with texts that went back 500 fucking years in Belgium. They did it just out of spite. They were an absolutely barbaric bunch of motherfuckers, which I guess that's why eventually they rolled on into the whole Nazi thing. But today, I mean, I think the German people are brilliant people, brilliantly wonderful people. They really are. Honest to God, some of the finest people on earth. I mean that. But so anyway, through the month of August, until the end of the month of August, when everything suddenly started to turn in favor of the Allies, and what the Germans thought would be a six-week war. They thought that World War One would be a six-week fucking war. They'd knock off France. They'd knock off the Russians. They'd run Europe. Their little partner down there, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, they'd be set. They would have stepped all over the fucking Serbians. The Russians would have been brought to fucking heel again, not too long after the Japanese, you know, Russo-Russian War, and Germany. 6 weeks. And it was looking that way. By the end of August, they were 30 miles from Paris. They were unstoppable. The British had their heads so far up their fucking asses. And one of the great things about this book, Barbara Tuchman is brilliant. I mean, everything I get my hands on that she's written, I'll read, because she's not only a great historian, but she's a storyteller, man. She's fucking amazing. I forget what I was going to say. Oh, so the British, I don't know, but allegedly or apparently, history tells us, because I'm not really that heavy into World War One history. History tells us the British, in those opening weeks of World War One, were very heroic, and there was a very small expeditionary force. The British came over. Let's give the British credit where credit is due. All these fucking wars break out, and what are they? They're over there trying to cool it out, you know, with their 10,000 men or 15,000 men until the shit gets out of hand, and then they got to, you know, they're all in. But there is this sort of myth about the British holding off the Germans. It's complete bullshit. The British, not because they were not brave men. It's got nothing to do with the bravery of the soldiers or the willingness of the nation to jump in and help the French. None of that. It had to do with their generals and their generalship and what they thought they should do and what they thought they would do. And the dumbest motherfuckers you have ever in your life. Honest to God. So you have that, and it was looking bad. And then at the end of the month, somebody is sitting in a war room in Paris. A bunch of generals. Germans are 35 miles from Paris. He looks up at the map that they have, that all war rooms have. There's the map. There are the pins. There are the armies. There are the units. There's the enemy force. Here's our force. Here's the movement. And you study this map, and what you try to do is figure out, what's he going to do next? What's the enemy going to do next? Where is he going to pivot from? Is he going to wheel about? And he, and I forget the man's name, is a captain recovering actually from a wound. And another officer, at the same time, they looked up and they saw the same thing, that the Germans had Germans were trying to turn, and the whole flank of the German army was exposed. And from that, the French suddenly realized, we need to counterattack right fucking now. Keep in mind, they'd been doing nothing but retreating for a month. Nothing but retreating. And that became, the famous counterattack became the Battle of the Marne, which is a very famous battle. They saved Paris, and what they actually did was turn it into a four-year war, you know, a 4 or 5 year war, because, like I said, it was supposed to be a quick bang, knock out the French, knock out the British, bang, we own the goddamn continent. Didn't happen. The French turned the Germans back, forced them into a retreat, but not a full retreat, just far enough where they dug in, and hence that trench warfare that we hear so much about, which is just, you know, back and forth sniping at each other from trenches and shit. What the hell is on my phone? I wish my show was this. I could just talk about this shit forever, but it's not. And there's a famous The Taxis of Paris. Maybe you heard of it if you follow World War One history, but the Taxis of Paris, they needed transportation to the front. They had to get soldiers to the front fast. They saw what they could do. They saw that the Germans had made a terrible, terrible mistake, that there was an entire part of their force that had no defense. They would have to pivot like 45 degrees. And when you're talking about thousands of men, that is a lot. And they said, we got to rush troops to the front right fucking now and go into a counterattack. And these guys were tired. These guys had had no sleep. These guys had been retreating for a month. These guys were hungry as shit. They, you know, keep in mind, they were still dependent upon a horse cavalry for the most part in those days. The horses were half dead. How are we going to get these guys at the front? They used taxis. Taxis. The taxi drivers and the taxi cabs of Paris literally took tens of thousands of men to the front outside of Paris. And it's a great story, man. It's an amazing story. It's a great book. And the book ends, which I love about Barbara Tuchman, because she says, I'm writing about the month of August. The Battle of the Marne took place in September. I think she writes about a couple of days in September, but the Battle of the Marne, I don't think, was until mid-September. So the book ends with the final decision, we're going to do it. Because you had to talk the fucking British into it. The British weren't sure. They would rather retreat because they had to save. The whole idea of the British, we got 10,000 men on the continent. We're gonna that's our professional force of men. We're going to wipe them out in one goddamn month to save your ass. We thought you just needed us for... They had a lot of bullshit excuses. Well, they talked the British into it. They turned a bunch of French armies around. And the commander-in-chief of the French, at that time, a man named Joffrey, I think, said, we're doing it. And that's the end of the book. But there's an afterword. And in the afterword, she explains what became the Battle of the Marne and what happened. And and she gets into the diaries and the journals of these people. And she quoted some of the journals and diaries of the German generals. Well, after the war was over, these men were writing their memoirs. And the guy said, he said, I never in my life, he said, I know a guy will fight and die in place. We know this when we plan a battle. We know a soldier will fight and die right where he is. But we had no fucking idea of the resilience of a soldier that had been in retreat, was tired, was hungry, was filthy, and was ordered to turn around, and you blast a bugle, and he goes into a counterattack. We had no idea what the capability of a man like that was until the Marne, you know, until that. And that's what the French soldiers did. You know, they had nothing. But what they did determine was, look, give these guys a chance to fight. They'd been retreating. He says, you give a man a chance to go into a counterattack, and that is worth a whole lot of sleep. That is worth a whole lot of food. That just, at least he gets a shot to get a few punches in. You know, it's one thing to be on your heels, man, and hungry and tired and dirty and filthy, and there's nobody, you know. It's another thing entirely, at least to be able to counterattack against an enemy that's been doing nothing but harassing you from, you know, the opening minutes of the war, from the border of Belgium and Germany all the way back to within 30 miles of Paris. And the Belgian soldiers, I mean, they were amazing too. They were fucking amazing. This little tiny dinky army, but they blew bridges, they blew all kinds of they made life tough for the Germans. And then they retreated to Antwerp, figuring we're going to hold on to this fucking port. They had enough guys to do it too. Then, you know, it's one thing in a modern air force, you know, bomb the shit out of a port, but this was World War One. So what the Germans did have is they had a lot of guns, big, big fucking heavy guns that could shoot a projectile 2, 3, 4, 5 miles. But the Belgian army retreated back to Antwerp, and so they did their part because the Germans always had to worry about them sitting up there. So it's a great book. Just finished that one, and I read another one by Barbara Tuchman years ago called A Distant Mirror, History of the 14th Century. That's a goddamn great book. The reason why, I know, people get, oh, that sounds like some real sexy reading there, Phil. For a schlub like me, for a wonk, for a history wonk like me, yeah. And she calls it Distant Mirror because the 14th century and the, when she wrote it at the time, the 20th century were so similar. The same kind of geographic upheaval in you know, large wars where political systems were changed. Disease, pandemic disease. The, you know, not the fall of religion, but the beginning stages of sort of the Enlightenment, you know, the moving away from the superstitions of religion. Because what happened in the 14th century, the Black Death, the bubonic plague, it changed the entire economic system of Europe. Because so many people died, there was a labor shortage. And so serfs, feudal serfs, basically indentured or enslaved people, no. Gonna have to pay me now, motherfucker. Well, no, you're my feudal. No, really? I'm going down the fucking road. How about that? You want work? I'll work. It's gonna cost you. And began the free tradesmen and that kind of thing. And as far as religion goes, I mean, it was the belief of astrologers and people like that that disease was caused by the positioning of the stars or these the waves of air were wrong. We're, you know, way the fuck out there stuff. And they began to really look at science anew. You know, they began to look at nature differently. Wait a minute. They found out. You know the king?
Yeah.
He lives way up in that fucking castle there. Right. He didn't get the Black Death. So what are you saying? There were a lot of people that were together. Yeah, they got it. I don't know. They're passing it to each other. But he's way the fuck away. He didn't get that shit. Well, you sure it isn't because he's royal and regal and that the god is smiling? No, that isn't that. That's not that at all. And so they started to figure some shit out. Not much, but just enough, you know.
Ewing.
I'm on fire.
All right, now I got to find something here, man, because if I don't, I'm going to be a world of hurt. I'm going to be a world of hurt, man. What am I looking for? Oh. I got a weird thing happening. Some people out there, you can give me a hand with this. In my kitchen at my house, I just got an email from my buddy Don. Thought you might find this interesting. Have you done work for any of these video game companies? I'll read this later, Donnie. Thank you. You know, I know that there's a job action, if you will, being threatened, I think, by the union against video game makers because these video game voiceover jobs are what they call throat thrashers. They will rip your throat out of your gut, out of your fucking neck, because they're hour after hour after hour. I don't know how much they pay, but they do not pay a standard residual. Now, I had a discussion with one of my mates, and they said, well, yes, they do. I said, well, if it's $1 million an episode, something about production costs. The episode, if the production is a certain level of production, then you get residuals. Like, I don't know, like, for instance, The Simpsons, something like that. Although The Simpsons, that's not a video game. I don't know, but it has to do with new media, the new media contract. The new media contract is what we're using right now, new media. The interwebs. I got to find my man here, Scott. Here he is. Week of 10/24. That's the week we're in right now, right? Yep. Oh, look at this. Oh, yeah. What day is this, man? One of the things I fucked up on this day of the week shit. 5? Oh, it was a podcast one, bro. Rich Uncles. Just did 3. By the way, my movement watch, you guys, buy it now. Go to mvmt.com, movement.com, and use our magical code, Phil, P-H-I-L. Get you some money off on that thing, man. It's a great watch, dude. It's a beautiful watch. Beautiful style. It's a little loose for me. It's a bracelet, which I don't mind that, but it's just still a little loose. $140. What is this?
Every Tuesday on Podcast One. Isn't that exciting?
I'm excited, except we're going to subject ourselves to some painful things to figure out.